October 18, 1988, my own lecture to the Anthropological Society of Washington, held at the National Museum of Natural History, Smithsonian Institution, Washington, D.C.
It's my privilege to introduce Dr. Helen Rountree, who is both a colleague and a friend. Helen got her bachelor's summa cum laude in sociology and anthropology from the College of William & Mary in 1966. In 1968, she received her master's in anthropology from the University of Utah at Salt Lake City with a thesis entitled Between Two Cultures, The Life History of a Western Shoshone Woman. In 1973, she received her doctorate in anthropology from the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee with a dissertation done under the direction of Professor Nancy Lurie. Title of her dissertation, Indian Land Loss in Virginia, a Prototype of Federal Indian Policy. Presently, Dr. Rountree is Associate Professor of Anthropology at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. Among her many interests are Eastern Algonquins, ethnohistory, culture change, Indian land tenure, and legal anthropology. The title of her presentation tonight is A Guide to Virginia Algonquin Usage of Ecological Zones.
Not use a podium, but to be sure you all hear me, I am going to use a mic, even though I don't like those either. I've actually expanded my paper a little beyond Virginia. I've used the paper as an excuse to invade Maryland. So I'm covering the Chesapeake region. I'm going to do a lot of it tonight with maps. Although the map that you see in front of you does not cover the entire Chesapeake, I found I didn't have a poster board that big. So we'll stick with everything from about the Choptank River down. I'm going to do first Indian use of ecological zones, and then I'm going to focus in on their usage of one particular ecological zone, which is the one in which they built their towns. And lastly, I'm going to be telling you what kind of predictions I would make about what an archaeologist would find in these towns. And those of you who have dug up those towns can tell me, or the rest of you, whether the predictions are coming true. I'll be talking about ideal conditions. Since my specialty covers really from 1570 to the present, I'm also going to be doing Indian towns of about 1700 to wind the thing up. And if I keep you awake the entire time, good. All of this, however, is going to be done with maps. If I have time and I find your eyes have not glazed over, I'll be throwing in a few slides too, but it's the standard old John White paintings that everybody knows. I have nothing really new to offer there. But the maps, perhaps something new. All right, we are dealing with a very, very diverse area ecologically. It is diverse for a number of reasons. The first and foremost one is the salinity of the water, and that's what these varying shades of blue on the map represent. You're looking first in the lower bay at some very saline water. It's almost as saline as ocean water, but not quite as salty. In the next blue, you are looking at the saltier part of the oligohaline zone, which is still salty enough that oysters will grow, but it is not fresh enough that a number of really important aquatic plants would grow. And the Indians took notice of this difference. We don't so much now, but the Indians did. And the very lightest blue, which on this map shows only in the rivers far, far up, is fresh water. All right. Not only have you got different salinities of water, which will influence what plants will grow and what marine animals will exist, but you've also got variations in topography. We go all the way from tidal flats, either saltwater or freshwater, up to some rather hilly country. And the rivers in the region, particularly the ones in Virginia that I know the best, tend to run through floodplains, and at times they meander. And the floodplains are going to turn out to be very, very important to Indian folks. Rolling country, a bit less so. So let me take you through some of the ecological zones and what kind of archaeological sites from the late woodland, the very late woodland, you might expect to find in each one. And as I go, I'll try and make a few half-baked predictions. I'll say at the outset, I've done almost no archaeology in this region. I tried it in Arizona for a summer, didn't like it, and never went back. So those of you who are archaeologists, you can test what I'm saying. All right, first of all, the first zone, which we now put a very high value on, and the Indians, and also our own immediate ancestors, put practically no value on, is the beach zone. Beaches were only places to get across, as far as Indian folks were concerned. Beaches were not a place where you could get much food per se, unless you wanted to go after coquina, which is a lot of work, little bitty shell-like things, or if some nice fish wash up on the beach, that's fine. But the beach itself is a way station between more valuable lands inland and the waters in which you can get more important food like clams and oysters. So beachfront property, per se, was not valuable in Indian times any more than it was to Anglos who were into farming. It's not good country. I'll make a little footnote here. I've done title searches on a good deal of the Virginia Beach beachfront, south of the resort area, which is now naval property. And I did the title search for the Navy. That sort of land was selling for something on the order of $10 an acre until about 1880. And then it went up to about $50 per acre. And by the time that everybody really began to get interested, the Navy grabbed it. But it's only when you get resort usage, when you get recreation, that beachfront really, really becomes popular. And the Indians of this region were fishermen and farmers. So you're not going to have that much emphasis upon beaches per se. They would do their fishing by canoe, and you can push a canoe off from an awful lot of places. It doesn't have to be beach. So far as really important sites are concerned, or really any sites, even if a beach was the kind of place where things would be preserved, you wouldn't have much. So we will scratch out Virginia Beach, and we will scratch out Buckrow Beach. These are the beaches I know, and a series of beaches along here, and little bitty beaches along here, little pocket beaches, and I believe along here. I really should have done all the topo maps looking for beaches. I went looking for other stuff on the topo maps. But any beaches that you find up around farther up the river are not going to be terribly important. The next area, ecologically, is the dune zone, and Indians were not but so fascinated with that either. Dunes were another thing to get across. So far as food is concerned that people could gather, in some of the slightly richer dune zones, you might get a persimmon tree or two and some wild grapes, and that's about it. So Indian folks were probably not going to be even camping much there, unless they absolutely had to. Add to that that the style of Indian housing that was documented was of a relatively flimsy kind, at least when they were making temporary camps. And if it's exposed to winds with even decent gusts, the stuff was liable to blow down. And the Indian preference was very probably not for dunes with their exposure to wind, but rather to waterfront property that had some stands of trees right close by it, and you build your camp under the trees. They also had to worry about firewood, and there's not a heck of a lot of firewood out in the dune zone. So we can eliminate the dunes, and I'll use the same red lines. There is one other ecological zone that is in the phytogeographies of the region, and it's probably not much of much importance to you if you live up around here. That's the dune forest zone, and the only place I really know it exists is in Seashore State Park down in Virginia Beach. That's going to get a big X. It's right in there. Fascinating stuff to walk through. I love walking there. These are very high dunes, and because they are close to the ocean and they are also high enough to be protected, it's about the farthest north extension of Spanish moss. So if you want to see Spanish moss, there is some within a couple of hundred miles of here outside of a herbarium. But so far as food is concerned, again, it's not good. There is a forest, true, but most of it is loblolly pine. The other trees in it are likely to be, at best, scrubby oaks. And if I can remember the list that I tried to commit to memory, they are live oak, laurel oak, and Spanish oak, which do produce acorns. And critters will eat the acorns, and the best thing for people to do is shoot and eat the critters. There are also some pignut hickories, scrubby ones, but you've got to compete with the critters for them. So the food getting is not particularly good, whether you are gathering edible plants or whether you're hunting critters. It was an area that people might have camped in if they really were getting pushed, but otherwise it's not ideal. All right, this brings us to the next zone, which people would go to for food, but they wouldn't camp in, which is just as well. This is the saltwater marsh zone, and there's a lot of that. I'm going to mark it in with yellow. There's loads of it, for instance, along the eastern part of the eastern shore. All these islands are actually saltwater marsh. There are extensive zones of it all along the western edge of the bay, unless the cliffs come down too high. Tons of it in southeastern Virginia. The place is lousy with saltwater marsh. And there is a small lining of saltwater marsh along many of these smaller creeks as well. Now, saltwater marsh is not a bad thing to have in your territory, although it's still not as good from the Indian standpoint as freshwater marsh. Saltwater marsh, as far as I've been able to discover, does not really produce plants that are edible by people. It produces a rather tough set of grasses and of reeds and so on, and these are useful for building materials and for making baskets and that sort of thing, up to a point. But edible plants, no. And the Indians' minds were firmly fixed in their stomach, if you can believe the English colonists. And if an area didn't produce enough food, then the heck with it. What the saltwater marsh does produce instead is animals on a rather small scale. If you're absolutely starving, pennywinkles are real easy to get. Periwinkles, sorry. I grew up calling them pennywinkles. There are saltwater mussels, which are edible, contrary to modern opinion. There are oysters that will grow up to the edge of it, but they're better actually out under the waterways. And I'll come to waterways, because that's a heavy use area later. There are, at high tide, blue crabs, which you might be able to catch, and also a variety of minnows and sometimes slightly bigger things. And in the saltwater marsh, when it's of any real extent, there will be a lot of these waterways going through it. And those waterways will be populated by fish of considerable size, crabs of considerable size, and also in season they're a haven for migratory ducks, especially ducks that like to dive onto a shallow, muddy sort of bottom. So it's rather good hunting territory. But you've got to know exactly what you're doing, and the English initially were not particularly good at that. So that takes care of saltwater marsh. All of these areas that I've listed so far, four zones, were areas of non-intensive Indian use, which is just as well for you archaeologists, because they're not good places for you to go hunting artifacts. Take heart, the Indians didn't use them that much. Now we get to areas of moderately intensive use. And here you may do a little knuckle chewing. One of the areas that I think has been undersold, it may just be this year's bee in the bonnet, is freshwater marsh. I've been finding some really interesting correlations between Indian populations and the amount of freshwater marsh in the area. I didn't invent the idea. Randy Turner's the one who suggested it to me. But I'm going to show you a map of the Rappahannock before we're done, and there are some really interesting correlations. Freshwater marsh is marsh that exists either in freshwater or in the fresher part of the oligohaline zone. So it's the two lighter shades of blue. And as you can see, all these major rivers have got a considerable amount of it upriver. And if you're familiar with your John Smith map, you'll know that that's where an awful lot of the Indian villages were in this part of the world. They tended to go upriver. And the marsh may have been one factor in it. Freshwater marsh produces the following animals. It's going to be pretty much like saltwater, except for different species. It produces freshwater mussels, which are edible. They also produce freshwater pearls, which were considered valuable for jewelry and the like in Indian society. You've also got clams upriver, a number of different types of them. In the high tide zone, you're liable to find fish at certain times. These upriver areas are going to be teeming with anadromous fish in the spring, so the fishing will be wonderful at times, and some of these things will come into the freshwater marsh area. But the part of freshwater marsh that the Indians appear to have homed in on the most, if you can believe John Smith, is the edible plants. And that applies to freshwater marsh and also to the swamps. And most of these tributaries of the rivers, if you're far enough upriver, will have a freshwater swamp at the head of them. So swamps and freshwater marsh, both, were important auxiliary areas for Indian folks who wanted to go gathering plants. There's one particularly important plant that John Smith mentions by name that grows in such areas, and that's tuckahoe, Peltandra virginica, which is arrow arum. Tuckahoe was used at the very end of the spring and the beginning of the summer when the winter corn supplies had run out and people were beginning to have a real hard time making it. And they would go into these marshes and gather the roots of tuckahoe. They would have to leach out the tannin in them, tannic acid in them, and then they could make what he called a passable bread. I've got to get to work and try some of the stuff. I haven't tried it yet. All right. This is a hard season food, and as such, it became very important. It was something that could be gathered when other things had not yet come ripe, like corn and like some kind of berries. It was a hard time food. It was also edible, I understand, though not at its best, year-round. So if you're having a hard time, if the English come and zap you in the fall right after your harvest and take all your corn away, if you still know where there's enough arrow arum, you can make it. So people kept track of where there was a really good stand of tuckahoe. Cudenemans is what it appears as later in the century. And people would specifically keep up their treaty rights in order to be able to gather cudenemans, which means arrow, arum, at various seasons, even if the land was claimed by Englishmen. Treaty rights like that kept Indian culture alive an extra length of time. And I'll come back to that when I talk about late villages. It's one of the things that did keep traditional culture going longer than most of us realize. There are other things in the freshwater marsh that can be used, although the English don't mention them. They may not have been quite as important. They include, if I can get my list straight again, they include cattail, the root of which is edible, and the young shoots in the spring are edible. They include golden club, which grows in both marshes and swamps when they're fresh water. And there's one other that is going straight out of my head. There are four altogether. But Tuckahoe's the main one. So we have to take a good hard look at marshes, what marshes are available. As for proving archaeologically that they got used, that's going to be a little hard because root crops do not preserve particularly well. But we can look at least and try to estimate population, and that might get at it a little bit. All right, that's swamps and freshwater marsh. Oh, and keep in mind swamps, because a fair number of late villages were on swamps. That's things that the whites didn't want, but the Indians knew how to use them. All right, the next area that people were putting to use, only in a moderately intensive way, was the oak flats, as they're called, that surround swamps. It is not the world's best area in which to try to do any farming, as people have found out frequently. But because the predominant trees are oak trees, there are about eight different oak trees that grow there, there are going to be lots of acorns and a fair number of critters that people can hunt. And also, people can gather the acorns. I believe they've also got pignut hickories growing in these things, too, so that's some nuts people can eat directly. So the oak flats, or the lower oak zone around a swamp, is moderately useful, and Indian folks would use that for foraging, strictly for foraging, and at most you might find a temporary camp. One last area for medium intensive use, and then I'll tell you what I'd expect to find in a camp. Medium intensive use, you also find pine barrens. Now the true pine barrens tend to grow south of Virginia, but you can make a case for calling some of these recolonizing pine forests after clearing or cutting over. You could call those pine barrens. I've seen several different ways of using the term, and you can accept a fair number of deciduous trees mixed in as long as they're not dominant. And eventually the hardwood trees will take over and it becomes technically deciduous forest. While you've got that many pine trees dominant, however, the eating is not all that good for Indian folks. Pines do not make a great many seeds that a lot of larger critters are liable to use. Squirrels will live on them reasonably well, but a lot of other critters would really prefer not to live there. So you're not going to find terribly rich animal life where the pines are that dominant. You're not going to find lots of deer. You'll find some. So again, that's strictly for foraging in Indian parlance. And it also means that old Indian fields let go fallow and growing up again. If they're not cleared again, they will go into pine barrens and then eventually become deciduous. Old fields are going to be places where Indians would only go hunting or occasionally gathering, mainly hunting. But not intensive use. Now we come to the two areas that Indian folks did use intensively. And I'll mark these, I really meant to mark swamps, almost anywhere that you've got an area far enough upriver. There are all sorts of little swamps up and down. Meanwhile, two major areas, all this is going to be freshwater marsh, two major areas that Indians would use intensively, and as luck would have it, in much of Virginia, the two are contiguous to each other. The first of these is the waterways themselves, particularly rivers and creeks, rather than the bay itself. Waterways were first and foremost avenues of communication. There is evidence in the land patents and in some of the early descriptions, and I footnoted it in the paper, that Indian folks tended to live on both sides of a waterway if the waterway were narrow enough. If it's too broad now, they'll center around a big tributary on the waterway. For example, on the Nansemond River, yes, you have people centering around the Nansemond, not on both sides of the James. But by the time you get up the James to Wyanok Point up here, there is good evidence that the Wyanok were living on both sides of the James and claiming territory on both sides of it. And once they had really tangled with the English in 1646, they only inhabited the south side. But until then, they were on both sides. And if you look at the distribution of villages on John Smith's map farther up the river, you will tend to see most of the king's houses on only one side, but the villages are more or less alternating, as though you have people who are deliberately sharing out territory, which may indicate some sort of political attachment between them. So waterways tended to be central. And if that holds true in Virginia, it's a standard Algonquian way. It's documented in Connecticut and also in Maine. A standard Algonquian way of looking at your territory. Water's the center. It's not a boundary. In English thinking, water's a boundary. England has rather different rivers. But for Indian folks, it's the center. It also means, and I don't digress into linguistics, but I will here for a moment, it also means that the people who spoke dialects most closely related to one another would be the neighbors on a waterway, not across a neck. Major avenues of communication. People were going out on the water continually. If they were practicing exogamy, there's nothing in English records to indicate it, but they probably did, they may have had a whole set of relatives and in-laws on both sides of these tributaries. And if you go visiting your relatives and in-laws, you meant going by water, and you push the canoe off and you go paddle, 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 and it's a lot quicker than going by land. So the waterways must have been traveled continually. Waterways are also major sources of food. There are all sorts of shellfish in them. By this I'm talking about bivalve shellfish, which applies to salty and freshwater both. Freshwater mussels upriver, saltwater mussels and clams downriver and out in the bay. And that food is always there for the gathering. It's a cold weather, harsh time of year food, and it's documented that way in John Smith. Likewise, waters are full of fish, although you've got to be pretty canny in getting them at certain times. And in the harsh part of the year, which is the spring, it's not the pretty time, it's the hungry time, the people were said to live much upon their weirs, which means fish weirs, whether these were the V-shaped stone things in the upper parts of the rivers close to the fall line, or whether they were the things shown in John White paintings, which are long hedgens, a long hedgen, a trap at the very bottom, and then a couple of rather heart-shaped bays. That's a standard kind of fish weir, and I think that's what John White was trying to paint. That's a fish weir from modern times, and was diagrammed for me by a man in Fox Hill in my hometown. All right, this kind of thing, if you build it right, will pull in all sorts of fish, even at hungry times. So it's a good thing to have. So waterways were an essential way to get food, even in the hungry season. So waterways were continually used. When people went to a tribal council meeting, they would probably go up the river from their village to the king's house. They'd go most likely by canoe, because there are all these little marshes and creeks and inlets that you'd have to cross on foot. Go by canoe, it's a lot easier. When they were getting ready to have a tribal initiation of boys called the Huskanah, and it was usually done by tribes, only rarely by the entire Paramount chiefdom, they probably went to this thing by canoe. If they were dressed to the nines, they were wearing jewelry. Some of the jewelry probably fell into the water. There are probably goodies out there, archaeologists, down in the mud and the silt. And your chances of finding them are like the proverbial snowball in you know where. But waterways, major, major parts in Indian thinking. Now, the last area to go into is the one that archaeologists can get to. And this is the deciduous forest zone. And I just remembered, I didn't tell you what camps are like, but I'll bring it in later. The deciduous forest zone, which is actually most of the area of eastern Virginia and eastern Maryland. It covers a tremendous amount of area. It includes occasional pines, but it also has a wide variety of oaks which produce acorns. It has mockernut hickories, which will grow tremendous. It has pignut hickories, which will be in the understory, both of those producing nuts. It will produce black walnuts in the understory. Unless they get enough sunlight, then they'll become bigger. A lot of the trees in the deciduous forest zone will produce things that animals and people both can gather and eat. And the Indians were acutely aware of it. And the women and the children would go foraging regularly at the right season. Because there is all this mast, as they call it, coming to the ground, and also there are a wide variety of herbs and grasses and other things, if enough light filters through, there is going to be plentiful animal life, and this is going to be the best hunting territory as well. Hunting away from the rivers, away from the gardens, but still in deciduous forest, that was the main place that men went to get animals, particularly Virginia white-tailed deer, which was very high-status stuff. If you want to show that you are a real man and worthy of having not one, but about 17 wives, get a lot of deer. Either that or kill a lot of monocons. Right, that's a deciduous forest zone, extremely rich. But there was so much of it that the relatively small Indian populations, at least in 1607, there may have been epidemics, we can't prove it, but the relatively small Indian populations could be choosy about where they wanted to live. And they would choose only the very best places within the deciduous forest. And places will line up like so, next map.
Don't you dare.
Not in front of the speaker.
On the next map, I tried to put my impression, which archaeologists may or may not agree with, of what Indian villages went with. Houses. This is just plain villages, and I haven't got anybody sitting in the water, so I guess it's right. All right, if you will notice, all these villages are along the waterfront. The places are all places in which deciduous forest, intensive zone, meets waterfront, waterways, intensive zone. So that's two criteria that we know the Indians used, and the English figured that much out. So we need to look at other criteria that these folks were going to be using, and here we can get at a couple of them. First of all, I've already mentioned the freshwater marshes, and I've shown you approximately where they are. Most of them are going to be, remember, in the lighter two blue zones, either in the freshwater zone or the fresher oligohaline zone. And you will notice that the greatest concentrations on each river are well up in these zones. Indian folks were building predominantly upriver, and the freshwater zone with marshes, with plants that were available during the hungry season, may well have had something to do with this. There's another factor which applies in 1607. I can't tell you how far back in time it goes, but these were people who were under attack from a variety of enemies, and the enemies came from several places. I'm going to ignore the Siouxans from the west, because Indian folks did live up toward that frontier, which was the fall line, but as I'll tell you when I describe villages, they fortified their villages up there and went on living there. But the people who were down closer to the bay were liable to be under attack too, particularly the people in the upper part of the bay. These were the folks who felt the attacks of the people called Massawomics, whoever they were, probably Iroquoians, but we haven't really pinned them down. And I don't have any opinions about who those guys were, sorry. I don't have any educated guesses to make about it. But the Massawomics did come down the bay, and therefore they did come by canoe. They are documented as having met Englishmen at the top of the bay in canoes. They are also documented as having a skirmish with the Potawatomis in 1609 to 1610, probably 1610. That was Henry Spelman. He saw it happen. So they were canoe-born people, and they were able to harass large areas up this way. So anybody who was within canoeing range of the Massawomics was liable either to fortify their villages, which is what the people along the Patuxent River did, or else simply to try and hide their villages and go well upriver, which may have been one of the reasons the Nansemans were all upriver. The Nansemans are a little bit of a mystery, and I'll go into them when I talk about the next factor. They don't fit in some other ways. But going upriver, where it's a little harder to reach them, yeah, they may have done it for political reasons, for military reasons. So you've got enemies. Another reason for not living right close down to the bay, although there is hungry time food, remember, in oysters and clams that you can get. Indian houses, even when they were really solidly built, were not completely weatherproof. If you read William Strachey, you'll know that. And they usually tried to build their houses in groves of trees under some sort of cover to give them additional weatherproofing so they wouldn't be quite so subject to being blown away. All right. If you've been down in this area, and I grew up right there on that little creek, and there was nothing much for 200 miles between us and Crisfield, Maryland. The winds can be tremendous, and in the wintertime they feel absolutely arctic. It's one of the coldest places in Virginia. And it would be difficult to heat, as well as liable to be blowy. So it's a good reason for Indian folks not to live there, certainly in the winter, but maybe at any other season. And those saltwater marshes are still capable of producing wonderful mosquitoes. They can just carry you right on away. So you don't find these marshy areas much inhabited for a variety of reasons. Now, there's one last factor that I've only started in on, and Steve and I have already started arguing about it. When you take a look at soil surveys and look at where the rich lands were, a lot of those line up with Indian towns, too. Indian folks were looking for the best lands on which to plant their gardens. And really good gardening land, first of all, should be relatively flat, maybe not completely flat. You might have drainage problems, but relatively flat. And should also, for Indian agriculture, have rich, really fertile soil, because these were folks who did not use fertilizer. Forget Squanto teaching the pilgrims to drop the fish in the hole. Lin Chechi has argued that Squanto learned to do the fish in the hole bit from previously visiting Englishmen anyway. But there were no fish being dropped into the holes in Virginia. So when people did their farming, they wanted to work with the best land they could get. And they would either go with fertile land, naturally fertile land with organic matter in it, or if they couldn't get that, and we'll see in the Rappahannock, there are large areas where you can't get it, you take second best, which is warm soil, as it's called. It's soil in which the water table is low enough in the winter and the spring that it warms up a little faster and things will sprout a little sooner. So you get a slightly longer growing season. All right. When you start plotting out at least the modern distribution of these things, it works out rather well with Indian villages, again and again and again. I do it river by river in the paper, and I don't think I ought to take the time to do it now because it's been a long day. But you can see it repeatedly. The better lands are the ones that have got Indian villages on them. And in cases like the Patuxent, where there is some good land all the way up and down it, then their preference for being upriver, that is, choosing among good soils, would probably clue in more with the freshwater marsh and the Massawomic threat. But in other places, some of the very best land on the Rappahannock, as I'll show you in just a moment, is upriver. Some of the very best, most fertile, and also most of the flattest land is up there. And that's where you see the really heavy concentration of people. So I think there's a correlation. Soils can change over time, but I know that the modern configuration of soils does correlate rather well. Now, I said that the Nansemen were a mystery, and they are, because if you do a study of a soil survey in the city of Suffolk, it is now, the best soils on Nansemen River are right up a couple of miles up the river, and that's not where the Nansemens were living. The best soils are right around the Route 125 bridge on each side, and the Nansemens weren't living there. They were living farther up. And to make a choice like that, I can still see reasons. I can always come up with rationalizations, you see. One reason is that at least until just before the English came, and maybe a little after, the Nansemens had some enemies immediately to the east, and that was the Chesapeakes, who were not wiped out until about 1607 by Powhatan's organization. And the Nansemens and the Chesapeakes were probably at odds. And it's better to be a bit upriver. The Chesapeakes would come and zap you, you see, by water. You do everything by water, and you go and zap your neighbors by water. There may also, I need to study this, be a better correlation with some slightly fresher waters upriver. I don't know what the salinity of the Nansemen is. I need to look into that. But they may have had a little bit better shot at some more freshwater marshes up there. So there are probably reasons why the Nansemens were not living on the best land. But on so many other of these places where we've got soil surveys, there's a correlation. Now, Randy Turner is going to be really frustrated because he talks a good deal about the Pamunkey River. And you can see there are lots and lots of villages there. The most important political area was right there on Pamunkey Neck. The Pamunkey is an almost fresh river from its beginning, and as you go farther up, it becomes increasingly fresh. And it meanders beautifully, which means there's lots of marsh, lots of food, and none of the counties adjacent to the river have had any soil surveys published about them at all. So we have to wait for the Department of Agriculture to provide us with those. Okay. One other thing that I need to mention that has been remarked upon as a little odd, most of the Rappahannock towns, at least until you get up towards the Nantucketaconde at Portobago Bay, Most of those towns are on the north side. Now, Morris Mook suggested that since the Paramount Chief's major town was here, it's actually that dot. Maybe the people in the Rappahannock preferred to live across the river from him for fear that he would get displeased with them and come and zap them. Christian Faist would say they're not in the Powhatan organization at all, and therefore they were automatically at odds. I disagree with him there. So there may have been political reasons. I've suggested another one in the ethnography book on the Powhatan that I'm in the process of publishing. I think the dear boy Powhatan wanted all this area as a hunting preserve and managed to get it. But it's also, some of it, not such wonderful agricultural land compared to other places, and people may not have wanted to settle on places like Mobjack Bay. I insulted a man the other day from Mobjack Bay. He says it's God's country, and I said the soils ain't so great. So, but this may be hunting preserve. There's also evidence, however, that the Rappahannock, whose town Tappahannock I place in that particular dot, were using the other side of the river. They were at least visiting there, because when John Smith was taken a prisoner in late 1607, early 1608, up to the Rappahannock, he was taken to meet the Rappahannocks, but he doesn't say he crossed the river. So they were able to cross the river. They apparently had a town there. It is actually shown as such on the Zuniga map, which may or may not be accurate. All this stuff is up in the air. But these folks didn't see the Rappahannock as an absolute barrier, at the very least. All right. That's just a little bit of playing around with soil surveys and that sort of thing. Let's take a closer look at the Rappahannock, which is in a nice 7-foot map. And they're actually more extensive than that shows, because the fishing map didn't try to mark in all the possible marsh areas. I've looked at the topo maps, but I didn't have time to clue them on. But there are lots of marshes, particularly, notice, in this middle area. Stay tuned, because I'll put an overlay on that shows you where the villages were, and they'll correlate. The reddish line there indicates the edges of the floodplain, whether the floodplain ends in almost a scarp or whether it's in a very gentle slope. Wherever I saw flat or gently sloping area coming to an end, that was what I marked there. And it shows roughly the floodplain of the Rappahannock River. Anything riverside of those red lines, then, is relatively flat land. So just by topography, one would expect Indian towns to be located on some of those flats. That would be better area, generally speaking, than the higher rolling ground, unless you've actually got terraces. And in some places, there are terraces up above the floodplain, and there'll be good soil on it. But I haven't got soil survey on this yet. This just shows river and marshes. Now we'll stick on Indian towns, which again is my opinion of the Smith map. It is really that kind of day.
You didn't even...
My life's stony and I don't want to mess with it. All right. Notice the correlation of certainly Indian towns with flat lands and the relations to creeks. And I did trace it out with the Smith map. I don't have a good representation for you tonight of the Smith map. The Xerox machine that I had access to is dying. And it would not really give good enough resolution. But I tried to work in the various curves and the tributaries with Smith, and that was how it looked. And you can see that where you find a larger correlation, find a larger number, concentration of villages, particularly king's houses, you're going to have access to a good deal of marsh. Now we'll take a look at it with the soil survey added. And I did the soil survey business. I did the soil survey business entirely independently. And then only last night looked at how they matched up. Your turn.
I didn't do a thing, so help me.
Soil survey stuff is done more or less to scale, more or less. Where you see heavy yellow, that means naturally fertile land, still. Where you see yellow dots, so it makes it light yellow, that is less good land, but land that tends to warm up early. And if you'll notice, downriver, the land available to the Indians, sorry, it's so far down, the land available to the Indians
is actually rather poor land compared to what's upriver. And that probably has something else to do with why Indian folks did not prefer to live down there. There is a problem on the Rappahannock, the same problem that we've got with the Pamunkey River, and that is that some of the crucial areas, Essex and Caroline County, yeah, neither of these have got soil surveys published yet. So I can't say whether their soil is decent and the Indians rejected it, or whether the Indians knew better than to use it, or what was going on. I simply don't know. But so far as the North Bank is concerned, there is a close correlation between presently rich soils and Indian villages. And assuming that the soil was rich back then, which may not be a good assumption, I'm no soil scientist, but making that assumption, Indian folks had found the richest soils and marked them mentally and kept coming back to them. And if you've had over 1,000 years of trial and error, chances are you'll know where the good stuff is. So if you want to see, then, concentrations of Indian villages, I might add also that the heaviest population, according to John Smith's population estimates of warriors, is in the central area. The Tappahannock had more warriors than anybody else, and presumably a heavier population. And they are also in an area of rich soil and very rich marsh area. So it's all kind of indicative. All these factors ought to be added in. Now, as for what you can find, in a temporary camp, you can't expect to find just a lot. The housing was flimsy. It was sapling and mat stuff, but it was flimsy. And you'll be lucky if you find a few post holes. The trash is going to be limited. If it's a fishing area, you're going to find maybe fish bones, find oyster shells, clam shells, that sort of thing. People were probably not wearing a lot of jewelry. They were not putting on ceremonials. If it's a fishing area, I seriously doubt that they were even doing meditation before fishing, and no ritual that would involve tobacco smoking. So I'd be surprised if you find pipes. Some of you tell me if I'm right or wrong there. Now, with hunting, it was going to be a bit different. Hunting was considered high status, and this one source specifically, is Samuel Purchase of 1617, that says that Indian folks looked for omens before they went hunting. It's especially true of the communal hunt. And the looking of omens probably indicates some sort of ceremonial. Tobacco may have been involved, and you can expect to find some pipes. All right, so far as hunting sites are concerned, those would be very temporary also, because people didn't usually stay more than one night, even on the communal hunt. They decided where to move each day, and the women and the kids would drag everything behind them. Communal hunts did, however, have more stuff in the camp for the short time that it was there. Housing flimsy, yes. But the women and the kids were along, and they were expecting to do some normal cooking. They would carry some corn with them to make succotash. They would be carrying mortars. Mortars are specifically mentioned as being hauled along, and also some ceramic pots. So there would be some things to find. But the richest places to find anything are going to be in those villages where people were living for most of the year, not all of it, but most of the year. There you would find the dwelling houses, which would be longish houses. The sources are not clear whether they had squared off ends. John White said they did, but the Virginia sources don't say, or whether it was rounded. So with the newest house that Jamestown Settlement is putting up, I don't know if they're getting it right or not. There would be two doors in it, one in front, meaning one end, and the other a postern, as Strachey puts it, which could be either a side or a back door, according to Webster's Dictionary, but two doors in it. Moderately long, platform beds along each side, a hearth in the center. That would be a dwelling house. A king's house would be different. First of all, it would be considerably longer because it had more people in it. A chief would have a number of wives. If he were the paramount chief, he'd have loaves of them moving in and out in revolving door fashion. He would also have children in residence, so there'd be more people sleeping in the house. So there would be more, maybe cubicles, but certainly more beds in it. But another major thing about the king's house that ought to tip us off is that at the far end of the house, there would be a room, but no exterior door. Because across the end of that room, the outside end of the room, would be another platform bed, and that's what the king would sit on when he received visitors. So if you find some rather odd doorways, probably multiple doorways, but none at that far end, you've got something different. Temples would be different yet. Temples were generally long because they served as storehouses as well, but they had only one door, and that would be in the east end, according to Strachey. That east end would also be the only room that had a fire in it. You expect multiple hearths in it. At the king's house, one in a dwelling house in the center,
but in a temple only one in the East End. Then there would be some posts which ought to leave holes for a passage or a partition or something, and then you come to what Strachey called the chancel in the West End, and that's where the bier for the king's bone bundles would be. And that bier ought to be leaving some decent-sized posts, and they would be going across the width of the room. That's if you can find one of these places out in the woods, because as often as not, temples were out in the woods. They weren't all in the towns. The one that Robert Beverly broke into much later was away from the town. So that's the kind of housing you'd expect to find. Trash, all kinds of trash in a town, including jewelry, which would be freshwater pearls, shell beads of various kinds, and also copper, either in plates or in long links. It's called long links in Strachey. You'd also find more things in which pigment was ground up, because people expected to paint themselves red each day, a coon. So you're probably going to find some pigment evidence, and all the rest of it goes straight out of the head by this time. So far as burials are concerned, I do have one little extra thing to offer about burials. There are two kinds of burials described in the sources. That is, primary inhumations, which were supposedly for commoners, and that's mainly the James York River region. And there were secondary burials, exposure on a scaffold, or immediate deboweling and dealing with a skeleton and sticking in a temple or in a dwelling house. That's the way Spellman puts it. Supposedly for higher status people, but maybe also for commoners farther north. There are, however, another kind of burials, and that's cremations. And I finally thought of something to account for them, and I can't prove it. See if you guys can do it. The English sources do mention that when people became malefactors and were convicted of a crime and were killed, their bodies were burnt. Sometimes they were burned alive, sometimes they were killed first and then burnt. But the burning that you find in a cremation may possibly be an executed criminal. So, pretty thought. Now, traditional Powhatan culture, I can't talk from Maryland here nearly as well, but traditional Powhatan culture survived a lot longer than most people realize. If you look at standard histories of the region, and unless I continue beating on the Jamestown settlement, they'll give you the impression that the Indians were all gone and their culture was completely vanished by 1700, and this was not so. There were Indians still left. I'm going to do the maps again. No matter what we do, it screams at us.
Keeps people awake anyway.
Yes, it does.
Wakes them all up.
The map I want you to see. It's going to be kind of popularized, but bear with it. It shows where the Powhatan groups at least were in about 1700 and what happened to them later. This was strictly for tourists who were coming to the Chickahominy Fall Festival. I ran an information booth at the tribe's request this year. All right, these were the surviving tribes. The ones that are in parentheses are the ones that either had already lost their reservation or were questionable. I don't know when the Rappahannock Poor Tobacco lost their reservation because there's no document to tell me. Their land had been claimed for a long time before, and they simply got pushed off and no record was made. The Occohanic groups were moving back and forth to Maryland, and eventually they stayed in Maryland, and there's nothing in the Accomack County records to tell me when they left permanently, so I don't know when the land was gone. Christianized Nansemond had not really had lands of their own for at least 70 years, but they were still together as a group, and they are down to the present. They've held together. But all the other people had reservations. On these reservations, a reasonably traditional culture was still being practiced. I'm not just going by Robert Beverly, who tended to plagiarize Smith. If you've read your Beverly, you know his scholarly tradition of the time allowed him to do that copying. But there are travelers' accounts as well from the late 17th century, particularly in the Rappahannock region, that show that there were quite a bit of traditional customs going on. Housing remained traditional. And according to a traveler who visited the Pamunkey Reservation, they were still living in the old-fashioned Yehokans in 1759. That's cheap housing, though, if you can get a cheap house. Everybody appreciates that nowadays. One item that had changed almost immediately, although the people in it hadn't changed so much, was clothing. When people could afford English clothes, they would often buy them at least for dress-up purposes. So in a late Indian settlement, particularly one that is down closer to the river, if they were living as squatters, you can expect to find a fair amount of metal pieces from clothing and bone buttons and all that sort of thing. Fewer of them in the refugee settlements where people moved back into the swamps. Other parts of the culture, the diet appears to have been largely traditional, as far as we can tell, but with one major addition, which ought to show up archaeologically. The people had been willing to take on one European animal, and that was the pig. They didn't take them on as barnyard animals, though. They took them on and let them loose in the forest and then hunted them like deer. But beginning to hunt pigs, the pig bones are going to show up in the garbage. So far as the political organization is concerned, that was probably fading by 1700, and by 1750, even on the larger Pamunkey reservation, it was gone. Religion, the people who were building temples were still building at least small ones in the early 1700s. But eventually the religion seems to have become outmoded and people gave that up. But you could still find at least small temples. You ought to look for one on the old Chickahominy Reservation, which is up in here. That's the one Robert Beverly broke into. The only Virginia group recorded as going to talk about land, everybody going together, which is the day Beverly managed to get in, was the Chickahominy. And they had a meeting like that in 1694. It's in the records. So you ought to be able to find a Chickahominy temple, a smallish one, about 30 feet long, on their old reservation, and we know approximately where it was, between the two Herring Creeks. So there are some things you can find, even back in these less desirable areas, and this Chickahominy area is not nearly as desirable, mainly because there's less flat ground up there. I can't tell you what the soil's like, because there's no soil survey. But there's less flat ground, and the farming must have been poorer. But there were fewer people, fewer Indians to feed by that time. And people could keep a fairly traditional lifestyle going. They had permission, as long as they had a treaty, to go hunting and gathering, gathering cut anemones, remember, arrow arum, on unfenced, patented lands. And there were still a good many of these in 1700. Everything was patented, but most of it wasn't fenced. So they had hunting and gathering rights. They had fishing privileges. And one way or another, they had to go farther to get to these things. But if they made the trouble, they could still get the old traditional diet and keep some sort of population going. And the evidence is that they did for a much longer time than we usually give them credit for. All right, one last parting shot, and it is this. I'm not going to go back to one more map, but if you remember the one of the Overall Bay and all those red dots that are along the rivers, the prime Indian sites are on flatlands along the rivers, and these are all prime areas for developers today. They're all of them under threat, either by people who want to commute long distances in order to live in the country at night. There are more and more people living in Fredericksburg to commute to Washington, D.C., and they're willing to live outside of Fredericksburg in increasingly distant areas. And there are also increasingly more people who want the status symbol of a second house in the country for weekend use, and that can be farther afield yet. The whole Powhatan area, and you can also make a case for Conoy, is surrounded by cities: Baltimore, Washington, Fredericksburg, Richmond, and Old Megalopolis, where I come from, seven contiguous cities in the southeastern area. And people are going phenomenal distances to live out in the country and then go to work. I've become one of them in the last year. I commute 20 miles to work, and I wouldn't have dreamed of it a few years ago. All these prime areas for Indian places, being waterfront, are under threat. The view is beautiful. The recreational opportunities are just great. There's boating for so long. And not only that, if it's a big enough flat area, which the Indians would have loved, a developer can put even more houses in and make a bigger profit. You have whole developments going in at once. This is happening all over the Nansemond River now. They're at least in the planning stage. So the threat is increasing, and more of these sites are going to go into houses. The houses that are being built, people are now expecting to have basements, and they all expect to be on the sewer. And that means even deeper digging. So it means that anybody who is interested in the preservation of Indian sites is going to have to make even more noise than we have done before, because the threat is growing. But take it from somebody who's really studied it. The prime Indian sites are the prime development sites. There's no question of a correlation. It's a 100% correlation. So go out there and yell. Thank you.